We have been doing a sermon series on Joseph, and we've been talking about him for weeks. I hope it's been fun for you. This is the one I almost didn't do today, but I think it's got some interesting lessons for us to look at and see. We're going to recap a little bit to get us in the right place to hear what's going on. So we remember that Joseph comes from this large, dysfunctional family. He has 12 brothers and one sister, and even though he is the 11th, and when the story begins, the youngest, he has another one that comes a little later, a full brother of his. He is favored and honored by his father as the son of the dad's favorite wife. And he is put in charge over his brothers, and there's all kinds of friction and problems and dysfunctionality going on in the family. His brothers hate him so much. I forgot to mention, his dad gives him this beautiful coat of many colors or whatever it is, meaning that he's not to work, he's to oversee everything going on. And his brothers hate him so much that they plot to murder him and then tone it down just a little bit so that he's only sold into slavery and taken away to a foreign land. There he spends time working his way up the as far as he can go as a slave. When he is again unjustly punished and goes to prison, and in prison he hears of Pharaoh's dreams. Pharaoh has this dream that there are seven wonderful fat and sleek cows, is how they're described, who come out of the Nile and then consumed by seven very lean cattle. And then there's heads of grain that are consumed by heads of grain. And he doesn't know what it means, but he knows it means something. And Joseph comes along and interprets the dream for him, and because of his interpretation, Pharaoh sees that there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And he appoints Joseph to be the person to handle this situation. So he's going to store things up for 7 years, and then they'll have enough to get them through the time of difficulty. Well, everything happened just as Joseph predicted, and a famine is now spread throughout the ancient world. Egypt is prepared, but other lands are struggling. And his family back home in Palestine decides that they need help, and so Jacob sends his sons, all of them, 10 of them, all but one, the youngest son, is to stay with him because he loves them the most. He's still playing favorites. And he sends the other 10 to Egypt to get food. And so when they arrive there, just as Joseph had prophesied long ago, they bow down before him, and they don't recognize him because they think he's dead, because he's altered so much in appearance, because he's wearing Egyptian clothes, but he recognizes them. And we talked about, wow, this is like a revenge fantasy coming true, right? There they are in the palm of his hand, and he can do whatever he wishes because he holds all the cards. And we're going to see that he does something very interesting for the next several chapters. And this is the part that people read and they go, why is this here? What's going on here? And I've told you that there's a lot of ambiguity in this part of the story. You could read it one way, you could read it another way. He seems to be trying to decide about revenge, perhaps, some people think. Some people think he's trying to have them experience what he went through. And we're going to see he puts them in prison. He creates dilemmas and angst for them. He puts them through all kinds of different trials, but some other people read this and they go, he's putting them through trials so that they will become the kind of family they were meant to be. And certainly that is something that does take place here. Other people think he's just putting them through all these tests to see if they have changed, if they've become different people than they were before. At any rate, through all these different trials and tribulations he puts them through, we're going to see that they do, in fact, become a family, and they do have an opportunity for grace and forgiveness to transform their relationships. So, here's what he does right off the bat. He says to them, you're spies. Now, Egypt had all this food. There were people coming from lots of places that didn't have any. Some of them were coming with money to buy, but others were coming to scout it out to see if they could steal it for themselves. Right? That was happening. And so, that's a possibility. But they say to him what? They say, well, we're not spies, we're all brothers. Notice before they weren't all brothers together, they were separate and apart. But now we're all brothers, the sons of one father. And he says, well, is this all of you? And they go, no, there's another brother back home. And he says to them, I don't believe you, you're spies, but prove it. I'm going to hold all of you captives and you can send one person back to get your brother. And they all go, no, please don't do that, but he does. He puts them in prison for 3 days. There they are for 3 days, sitting there with angst and worry and fear. And then he brings them all out and he says, I've changed my mind. Instead of having all of you stay, I'm going to have one of you stay and the rest of you go home, but don't come back until you bring your brother. And they'll go, but Dad will never agree to that. And so they set off and they leave poor Simeon stuck there. You know, he drops out of the story for a while, but for months, a year, he's there in prison by himself, waiting for his family to come back and thinking they might not, right? They all go back home. They tell Dad what's happened, and he says, you did a terrible job. He's a wonderful father. He says, you did a terrible job. You shouldn't have told him all this. You did it all wrong, blah, 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 and you're not going back to get your brother. I might lose more, right? And I love Benjamin, and he's going to stay here. That's what Dad says. But you know what happens? After a while, the hunger gets so bad that they decide they have to do something. And so he sends him back a second time. All the brothers this time, including Benjamin. And again, Dad's unhappy. He complains and moans and groans about it. And they come in, and Joseph greets them this time, and he says, well, you came back. Did you bring your brother? Yes. And he says, well, then Simeon's free. And he throws a big banquet for them, and they're having this wonderful celebration. And they said, last time we were here, we bought all this stuff, but when we came home, the silver was back in our bags. We don't know how that happened. Here's double the silver this time around. And he says, okay, that's fine. And then they leave, and you know what he does? He puts the silver back in the sacks again, and this time he adds a cup, his own cup, that he puts in Benjamin's bag. Benjamin goes with it. They're all traveling. And then he sends his delegation to catch them. And they say, our cup's missing. Where is it? And they open Benjamin's bag, and there's the cup in it. And he says, he's going to be my slave for the rest of his life and going home. The rest of you are free to go. They could go home, right? They could abandon their brother. They did that to Joseph. I mean, they sold him as a slave. But this time around, they do something exactly the opposite. They go back home, and they go back to Joseph, and they say, please, please don't let that happen to us. And indeed, one of the brothers, Judah, says, hey, if you need to have somebody stay, let me stay. Send my brother home so that it will be a blessing to my father. That's the one he loves the most. And you see now family coming together. They're concerned for one another, how they are now willing to sacrifice themselves for each other. Some beautiful things are going on here in this passage, and there's just a lot to think about. So what's going on here? You know, revenge, is he playing with them? Is he helping them to become what they might be? Is he testing them to see if they've changed? All of the above? All those things I think are happening. But I'll tell you one thing that struck me as being worth us considering and thinking about is the whole role that struggles and difficulties play in spiritual growth for us. You know, certainly struggles can bring us together. They can make us stronger. Of course, you could also argue that struggles can break us apart and make us weaker too, right? It's how we deal with them and how we go forward. And yet, don't we intentionally have some times when we struggle? You know, we're going to watch a football game today. I was asking people about times when you go through an intentional struggle. And several people pointed out to me, when you're in sports, isn't that something you do? The coach says, you know, he puts you in situations where you're going to struggle and you face difficulty. I remember our coach in wrestling used to say, you know, we do these 6 minutes of this exercise that had a horrible name, so I'll skip it. But anyhow, we would do this thing, and 6 minutes is what he'd say, and you'd be just dying, and then he'd say, now 1 minute more. And, you know, you'd just be dying, but you'd try to do the 1 minute more to see if you could, right? Because they're putting you through stresses and difficulties to bring you together. Teams often talk about how they become a family, right? I was talking to a guy this week who said he was going to try out for a triathlon. He's, you know, 62 years old, and he said, I'm going to do that. And he says, I've done these before. He says, I'm usually the last one to finish, but I always finish. And you can see he's creating a difficulty so that he can become a better athlete, a better person, a stronger person. We go through these difficult things, right? And sometimes we create intentional obstacles. When my kids were younger, we used to go on family backpack trips. And part of the idea was, hey, you know, as we struggle and as we walk and hike, we become more of a family unit together, right? Doing those things. And in fact, struggles often do make you stronger. No struggles make you weak, but I will go and say this, that if you don't have any struggles, I think that is spiritually a danger and a bad thing. I think you need your struggles to become strong individually and as a church. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, I don't know if you knew this, he was raised as a Christian. Did anybody know that? Came from a Christian family. He was asked once why he didn't become a Christian, and he said, this is so sad, he said, because I never met one. Isn't that sad? He had a list of sins. It's an interesting list. He says, wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character. But the one I wanted to focus on today is worship without sacrifice. That is such an interesting idea, that there is no genuine worship without sacrifice. You know, this week, or maybe it was last week, in our Christian Believer class, we were talking about this because one of the speakers on our video said, you know, people in the past gave out of their need, out of their poverty. Today we give out of our abundance. And he was speaking of that negatively, and I said, well, that doesn't strike me as a bad thing. You know, what we need to be doing in giving of our time, our energy, and our money, and our resources is to give sacrificially. You know, and what I mean by that is to give in such a way that it impacts our life and makes us different people than we were before. I argue that sacrifices, I tell folks this all the time, a sacrifice is giving up something you love for something you love more. I'll say that again. Sacrifice is giving up something you love for something you love more. So it sets, creates, establishes, and emphasizes the priorities in our lives. Someone else put it this way, if you don't sacrifice for what you want becomes the sacrifice. And we could think of this in this way. If you want your family to be a priority, and yet when your kids come in the house, you don't ignore them and focus in on what you want, well, you're communicating something there, right? How often do we hear about spouses feeling like they move apart because they're no longer the priority in each other's lives, right? The same thing is true for love as it is for worship. It's true for us as individuals and true for us as churches. When I was going to seminary, I had a professor, Dewey Wallace, who said this, and I didn't believe at the time, but I've since found out was true. He said, if you want people to join your church or become involved in your congregation, it will never happen because of things you do for them. It will happen when you get them to do things for the church or for God. And I thought, wow. So what you're telling me is if we feed somebody or help them in some way, they won't come to our church. I put that to the test, you know, many times. But one time especially, we had a family in Eagle many years ago who going through a terrible time. And they came to us regularly to ask for gas help for their vehicles. So once a month. Now, I'll tell you, I never do that. I give out gas help much more infrequently than that. But this family, I made an exception. Every month, I gave them gas help, right? And they were like clockwork for 5 years. And every time I gave them gas money, you know what I said? Love to see you in church sometime. At the end of that 5 years, their life situation had changed. She says, this is the last time I'll need this. And she says, and by the way, I want to tell you something that I know you'll be happy about. We've started going to church. And I said, what church? She told me the name of the church, and I went, huh. 5 years, you come to us for help, but you don't ever come to our church. You go to another one. That's interesting, isn't it? I was a little torqued. Right? But it's true, when you do things for God, for the church, you're more likely to get involved, right? You're more likely to care. You think of people, all those folks who've been knitting all those prayer shawls down the years. They're doing something that is a blessing to God and others, right? When we give, when we contribute, when we serve, we're making this place, God, a priority in our lives. And I will tell you, that's often how we come to even feel love. You know, I've shared before that when my kids were born, you know, my wife was all, you know, the hormones, I love them. You know, she's going on and on about each one of our kids when they were born. And I each time went, ew, you know, they're a blob of protoplasm, feeling nothing. But you start doing things for them, and the next thing you know, the love starts coming, right? I think for a lot of us, that's what we experience. And what I say is true for individuals is also true for us as churches. It's the struggles that we go through that often make us committed and involved. That same professor I mentioned before also told us this. He says, churches, he says, have to be very careful about the endowments they receive. And he told us a story that's just fascinating. In New Haven, you know, it's near Yale, so there's all this money there, a lot of rich people, and there are three old churches on the green. That is this huge square park in the middle of town. And these churches have been there for hundreds of years, established around 1690. I mean, they've been there forever. And each of them, over the years, has blessed enough people that they have received these giant endowments, right? And I mean giant. So the time I was going to school, they had enough money to pay for a pastor, an assistant pastor, a choir director, an organist, and a janitor, all these full-time positions in the churches, all paid for by their endowments, buildings maintained, everything's going. Guess how many people were going to each of those churches? We have more here today than all three of those churches together by a long shot. Because why go? I mean, would you want to be a some people might enjoy that, but my guess is the quality people that would make a church function and thrive are not going to want to go there. You want to go someplace where you can serve and be a blessing and help and grow, right? And I also wonder, who do they get to be the pastor? Wouldn't that be just a soul-sucking job? I mean, this is challenging enough, but to go there and preach to 50 people or 40 or 30 or 20 who are not doing anything, who are just there as consumers. I'll tell you, there's an issue going on now in the church all over the country. I know you have to find a church that feeds you and meets your needs and helps you grow and provides things, but at the same time, you have to find a place where you're serving and growing, right? And that's what we tell folks. When you come here to our church, we want you to worship. We want you to find an area of service. We want you to be involved in a small group. We want you to be involved in an area of mission. Those are the things we would like you to do because we know it will help you grow spiritually, right? And that's what it's about. Sacrifice. You know, it's just an interesting thing to think about. And of course, today we're going to be celebrating the sacrament of Holy Communion. It makes us think about sacrifice, doesn't it? We think of Jesus' sacrifice to us and for us. He is, at the Last Supper, offering himself to his disciples. This is my body. This is my blood. And we know he's about to go to the cross, where he's going to literally offer himself in his life. And we come forward to receive that. But we also come forward to commit ourselves as a living sacrifice to Jesus Christ. When we come forward and kneel at the altar, we are offering ourselves to God for his service and for his purposes, committing ourselves to his kingdom. And, you know, I heard someone once say that every time we take communion, it's an altar call. You know, we're going forward to commit ourselves to say, this is what I believe, this is who I want to receive into my heart and life. And I would say, you know, our faith is a cause worth living and dying for. God has offered himself and given us a purpose that we can serve God and our neighbor. Let's bow in prayer. Lord, we know that we are often not all we should be or all we could be. We know there are sins and anger inside of ourselves, but that your grace covers all that. And so we come to receive from your hand your life that we might truly live, your body that we might be united with one another. And we come to receive, as we come to receive, we also come to offer ourselves, our service and our commitment to you and your cause. Bless us in this, we pray. Amen.